Good evening. My name is Chris Hoover. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
And it's good to be back. Billy, thank you. It's great to have a... It's great to be, you know, invited back somewhere. You know what I mean? Like, oh, okay. Didn't do all that bad the first time. So thank you. It's always an honor and privilege to come out and come down here. It's a great drive. It was raining a little bit before I left the house, but then it cleared up when I got on 66. So it was, I was like, all right, you know, it won't be a monsoon. Heading out. And my sobriety date is August 16, 2002. I have a home group, which is the Midtown group, and I have a sponsor. Just talked to him on the ride up, just checking in, you know, see how he's doing, you know what I mean? And I just celebrated 14 years. You know, and tonight would be, I'd be picking up a chip, you know, at my home group. But I'd rather be here, you know, I'd rather be here. And I can pick one up next week. And, but it's sort of sentimental to me because, you know, 14 years ago today, I was walking into my home group for the first time. And I had, you know, I was, my sobriety date is my release date from a, work release program, so I don't count the time I was incarcerated. Not that it doesn't count for anything, because it does, but it's, you know, it's very different. You know, inside's inside, out here is out here, and so it's a very different situation. I had been going to meetings. I had already met my sponsor, and I had been going to meetings while I was in this work release program. If anyone doesn't know what a work release program, sort of like jail light. You know what I mean? They lock you up at night, but you can leave during the day to do various things as long as it's just work in an AA meeting. You know, they'll let you out. And so I had been going to some meetings, and I would, you know, I'd go to some meetings with people, obviously, that a lot of people from my home group go to, and I would hear stories about the home group, but I couldn't go because they wouldn't let me. At that time, it was in D.C., and they wouldn't let me go into D.C. for a number of reasons we don't need to get into, but they're probably like, you know, you probably don't really need to go down to D.C. for anything. And you don't have a whole lot of leverage in a work release program. I mean, you can say what you want, but they're probably not going to listen to you. And so I would hear about this home group, and it almost took on some sort of a mythical proportion by the time I had gone there. And it was... it was a hot August day, like today, you know, and maybe even hotter. And I walked into this church basement and down in D.C., 22nd and P Street, and I had never seen so many people in an AA meeting before in my life, you know. I mean, never in my life, and there were hundreds of people. And the greeting line went from the outside sidewalk all the way down the stairs. Then there was another set of stairs that you had to go down into the sort of main area. And there probably were 30 people in the greeting line. And I was terrified, you know. I was terrified. And as soon as I walked in, I got some coffee, and I'm walking back, you know. I'm going to sit with my sponsor because I don't know what's going on. And, you know, I just stick close to him. And this guy comes up to me, I guess... I didn't know it, but he was my grand sponsor, and he said, you know, you don't have to act like that. You're not locked up anymore. And that was my first resentment in AA, so, you know, I was complaining to my sponsor about it that night, you know. I was like, who the heck is this guy? What, he's talking to me like this, you know how we are, and so easily offended. And so, so it's good, you know, it's a sort of special moment for me, and... to think about, you know, my life and in sobriety, you know, where I was and what happened and, you know, what my life looks like today is it's a total 180. I mean, it's very different. And just to get a poll, see where everyone's at, if you have under a year, raise your hand. And, you know, so let's go. So we got some new people here. And I didn't understand what was wrong with me, you know. And if you're new, you probably... don't understand either, you know, and I, you know, grew up and I was born in Washington, D.C., and I grew up in sort of the D.C. area. My family moved out of the suburbs shortly after that, and I grew up sort of Chevy Chase, Bethesda area, and, you know, I was a troublemaker kid, you know, in school. I'm the only boy in a family of four girls, so I've got four sisters. And so I was probably spoiled a little bit. I'm not going to lie, you know what I mean? My grandmother played favorites, you know. I was certainly spoiled a little bit. But I seem to always have this sort of, you know, like I deserve something, you know, this sort of righteous air about me that that I was owed something. And I don't know where that comes from, you know. Maybe it's because I was spoiled. Who knows? But I was a class clown in school, and I got kicked out of my first Catholic school in the fourth grade for throwing this guy John Leonardo's books on the roof because he was kind of a bully, and I was, you know, sort of a, you know, I don't like bullies, so me and my friends threw all his books up on the roof, and, you know, and I had some words with the nun, and she washed my mouth out with liquid hand soap, and that was it, you know what I mean? That was it for Catholic school for me. So I went to public schools from that point on, and I was just sort of a troublemaker, and I never took school seriously, really. I rose to the level of nuisance, I think, you know, no real trouble, and class clown. When I was 15, I was about, 14, 15, I'm not sure when you go to high school, it's been a long time, so... My dad was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and obviously that's a big shock, you know, it's a big shock to the family. And around the same time, my oldest sister had a manic episode in college and had to be brought home and institutionalized. She had later to find out she was bipolar, and my youngest sister was diagnosed with Asperger's around the same time. You know, so there's a lot going on when I was 14 or 15. None of this makes me an alcoholic, but it does set a stage, you know. And the book talks about alcoholism as a spiritual malady, you know. And that always confused me when I was new, you know. I'm just like, what are they talking about? You know what I mean? Like, what is this voodoo that they're this God, spiritual malady? What is this stuff, you know? And to me, a spiritual malady in layman's terms, and it talks about it, and in the appendix, spiritual awakening, right? A spiritual malady to me is I'm disconnected from you. And that's as simple as I'll make it. You know, there's something in between, you know, me and the rest of the world where I feel different, alone, frightened, you know, fearful. Whatever it is, you know, and it, some of those things could be different for different people, you know. And so I'm, you know, 14, 15, I don't know how old I am really, about to start my senior year of high school, big time for young guy, you know, puberty, all that stuff's happening, you know, getting interested in girls and things like that. And so all this chaos is happening in my house, and I guess what a well-adjusted, you know, human being would do is sort of lean in and say, where can we help? What's going on? That's what my other two sisters did, you know. They leaned in. They're caretakers, by natural caretakers, you know, leaned in. I leaned out, you know. And I don't know why. I mean, you could spend 100 years in therapy and try to figure this stuff out. You know what I mean? I never thought about it in that way until I got sober, you know. I leaned out. I didn't want anything to do with it, and it just seemed like a lot of chaos, and it seemed a perfect opportunity for me because all eyes weren't on me, you know, and I could kind of do what I wanted. And I'm also selfish and self-centered by nature. I don't have the words to describe myself in that way, but someone who doesn't want to be troubled, right, with their father dying of cancer couldn't be described any other way, right? Selfish and self-centered. And so there's the spiritual malady right there. That's the condition that I'm in before I drink, you know. And if you're new tonight and you're thinking to yourself, I'm in AA because I have a drinking problem, that's actually not why you're here, you know. I have a spiritual malady in which drinking solves that, right? Solves that problem, and you'll find out how in a little bit. So that's the condition I'm in when I'm 14 and 15, and I'm nowhere to be found. I'm out with my friends. I'm doing what, you know, teenagers do. And all this drama's happening, and, you know, ultimately, you know, 6 months later, my dad declined very quickly, and when he passed away in the house, you know, we brought him home. When he passed away in the house, my family had to go find me and bring me back and let me know that my dad passed away, you know. And I don't know about you, I'm not a father, you know, but if I had an only son, I would hope that he's with me, you know, if I'm on my deathbed. If I wanted anything, that's what I would have wanted, you know. And so I deprived my father of that. Now, I didn't think anything of it because I'm only thinking of myself, you know, in this capacity. What I'm thinking is now I have this chore set upon me that, you know, I'm at the funeral and people are telling me I need to be the man of the house. Now I have this one other thing I have to do, you know. I have this additional burden or responsibility, as it were, you know what I mean? And how can I do this, you know? Now, all of this is hindsight looking back. I didn't have the language to describe what was happening, you know, as this stuff's going on. But what I'm trying to do is paint the picture of the condition that I was in before I found alcohol, you know? And so, you know, here I am, I'm 15, and I'm going to high school, and, you know, life changes drastically, right? No father figure, you know, probably at a very important time for a young boy. And but I didn't see it that way. I didn't feel sorry for myself necessarily at first. I thought, well, you know, here's an opportunity. You know, my mom's very busy with, you know, four other girls. You know, I can do whatever I want. And that's what I did. And I think from the time I was 15 to the time I was 30 and I met my sponsor in that work release program, I had made pretty much every decision for myself that was possible. You know, I mean, at least, you know, the first couple of years until I moved out when I was, you know, 17, 18, it was, you know, there were some interventions with family, but it was fleeting and, you know, it held no water because everyone was occupied with all these other issues. And so I'm not drinking now at this point. I kind of muddled my way through high school. And somehow I graduate, you know, barely. I've probably had a few beers, you know, at cake parties, things like that. And I'm not trying to, you know, talk badly about beer. I just never really, you know, it tasted awful. And I'm not sure why people drink it. And so I haven't had my first drunk yet. I'm sort of a late bloomer, I guess, to drinking. And I barely graduate high school. I've got this sort of internship, screen printing T-shirts at a local printer. And I kind of like fell in love with it. And I bought some used equipment and started printing shirts at first my mom's bedroom, you know, in my mom's house. And in lieu of going to college, I started this business, you know, printing T-shirts, and me and a couple buddies. And I think, like, that summer after high school, my mom was like, look, you know, you're printing these T-shirts in the house. It smells like aerosol cans and you've got shipments of T-shirts coming in the front door. You got to move out. You know what I mean? And so that's what I did. I moved out and with these guys of mine that I was hanging out with and started this business with. And, you know, life started to, you know, take on a new dimension. And it was probably late that summer that I was, you know, one of our, you know, at that time I was, you know, 18. I was going down to D.C., I was going to clubs. And, you know, back then they had these things called raves, which I guess now they call festivals. Same thing, you know, techno music, drugs, girls. Fun, you know what I mean? So it's the same back then, right? You know, so I'm going to these parties and we're doing, you know, shirts and T-shirts for these events, and then there's this big event in Montreal, and you know, I take a road trip up to Montreal, and you know, we get to this thing, and you know, it's the events that weekend. We're up there on a Thursday at some bar, and you know, never been to Canada, you know, never been to Montreal, and we're at a bar, and we're, you know, just hanging out, and, you know, I was playing pool. I like to play pool when I go to places like that, and I wasn't thinking, you know, I need a drink or anything like that, you know. I wasn't thinking, like, wow, a drink would be great, you know. I wasn't thinking that I'm really stressed out with this business. I've got all these, you know, commitments. Now I'm, you know, I'm 18, about to turn 19. I've got, you know, employees and people back home that are relying on me. I'm, you know, I wasn't thinking any of that stuff. You know, I was thinking, here I am in Canada, and, you know, and my buddies asking me what I would like to drink. And being sort of new at the game, I said, well, as long as it's not beer, you know, I'm happy. You know, just bring me, you know, whatever. Whatever you're drinking. And so he brought over a vodka cranberry, right? And I'm playing pool, and I start sipping this vodka cranberry, and it's very delicious, you know. There's probably very little alcohol in it. Who knows? I'm just like, you know, the waitress keeps bringing them, you know. So I keep drinking them. I mean, you know, whatever, right? And about halfway through my sixth one, right, because I'm, you know, I don't know. I don't know how much you need to drink or how, you know. I have no idea. I've never been drunk. So about halfway through the sixth one, I just felt my shoulders drop a little bit, you know. I felt kind of at ease. I was at the pool table, and I used to bet money. I was pretty good at pool, so I always put money on a game. And my shoulders fell a little bit. I felt more comfortable. I wasn't second-guessing my shots, you know what I mean? The chatter in my head seemed to die down a little bit. I wasn't stressed out. I felt comfortable. I felt at ease. And I had a great night, you know? Nothing bad happened, you know what I mean? I probably lost some money on a pool game, you know? We did what we needed to do that weekend. I definitely drank more, you know, for sure. And we went home and back at work, back at business, you know, printing T-shirts. And little by little, I mean, I'm sober 14 years, and I drank for about 14 years, you know. And so little by little, my life revolved around drinking, you know. And it wasn't a sort of a, you know, rapid decline at all. And I was, you know, I had that business for about 3 or 4 years, and, you know, we built it up. We had over 250 clients, and, you know, I'm 19, 20 years old, you know, but to own a business, you know, requires sacrifice, you know what I mean? To be a business owner, to really build something requires effort, you know? And the more I drank and I got the feeling from that, you know what I mean, the less effort I was willing to put into my business, you know. Now, again, this is hindsight looking back. I didn't know that's what was happening, but that's what was happening. And I guess that's what normal people do, you know. They just do what it takes to succeed, you know. They put in the effort. They work hard. They pay their taxes, you know. But I'm a guy that is always looking for shortcuts, you know. I'm looking for maximum results with minimal effort. You know what I mean? And drinking is the perfect solution for that. You know, I've already got this spiritual malady. You know what I mean? It's already baked in at this point. You know, I don't trust people really. I don't believe in the institutions in the world. You know, I don't believe in God anymore. That's long gone. You know, that ended in fourth grade with the nun washing my mouth out with liquid hand soap. You know, so that's gone. You know, I'm firmly entrenched, you know, when I'm running this business, I'm firmly entrenched in the idea that you can only count on yourself, right? If something's going to be made or directed or accomplished, that it is you that's going to have to do it, you know what I mean? And that's a lot of pressure, right? One, it's impossible, right? No one can do that, you know, it's impossible. So it's an impossible task. Right? And two, the idea of failure becomes so great in your mind that drinking relieves that, you know? And I just got, you know, I just got involved in partying and hanging out and going to clubs and just really drinking my business away, you know, for the most part. And I had an offer, you know, 4 years into this thing. I'm now like 24, 23, and someone offered to buy it. And, you know, I sold it, and I sold the client list and the equipment, and, you know, I kind of got out of the business. And at the time, I would say to myself, you know, I just sort of grew apart from the business. You know, I just wanted to do something different. But the truth was, is I didn't want to put in the effort anymore. You know, I didn't want to dig in my heels and you know, make the sacrifices necessary. I just thought it was too much. And so I'm also, at the same time, I'm getting the feeling of an accomplishment every time I drink. You know what I mean? So I can, every time I get drunk, I feel like, you know, I feel like the guy I should have been after these successes, you know, even though I haven't accomplished anything really. And so that's sort of an elusive feeling that drinking does. You know, drinking gives you that feeling of a job well done, not having done anything really. And so drinking is becoming an important part of my life. There isn't any area of my life where I'm not drinking, you know. And doing sort of the things I was doing and staying out all night and, you know, 48 hours at a time partying. I mean, there are other things involved in that, you know. And but drinking was always the big show. I started the night with drinking. I ended the night with drinking. There were some, you know, additional activities in between for sure, right? But drinking was the big show. And so here I am. I'm out in the work world now. I have some skills because I've taught myself some skills while I was running that business. And I try to be, I try to be a normal guy, you know. I mean, and I don't think drinking has had any, at this point in my mind, I'm not even thinking I'm an alcoholic or anything like that. I don't have any DUIs. I don't have for Christ's sakes, I don't even have an alcohol citation for, you know, drinking. Nothing. I have nothing. There's nothing there, you know. And so, I'm just going about my life, and I'm partying 2, 3, 4, 5 nights a week, you know, thinking nothing of it. And you know, this sort of goes on for a number of years, and slowly but surely, you know, it becomes really impossible to show up for work, you know. And, you know, I think that as alcoholics, we're pretty smart, you know what I mean? Or maybe we're good con men or women, you know what I mean, as it may be. And, you know, I could always get a job, but keeping it is another story, you know what I mean? When the going gets tough, you know, at a certain point, I go to ABC Liquor, you know what I mean? and that's what I started doing on some of these jobs. I was, you know, doing computer stuff. After my business, I worked in the pre-press industry. So you're in like a closet, basically, on a computer all day long. So nobody's really monitoring you. So I figured, you know, go to ABC Liquor, you know, get a, you know, big cup, put some, you know, Coca-Cola in there, you know, fill it up with some rum and just drink. You know what I mean? Like, nobody's watching me. And so now I'm, you know, I'm partying all night. I'm drinking during the day, you know. And so holding on to a job became tenuous, you know, and it was tough. So, you know, losing job after job after job. And I always had a reason or an excuse, you know, it was the boss or this guy didn't like me or whatever. They were trying to push me out. I was, you know, they felt threatened by my, you know, experience and skill, you know what I mean? Whatever the case may be. I mean, you know, you tell yourself a million lies. And so I think at one point I was working at this job, and they actually let me go because they caught me smoking pot in the bathroom. So that was not cool, you know what I mean? And when you're caught like red-handed, you know, it's hard to like deny it, you know what I mean? And so they fired me, you know, and I went on unemployment for a little while, you know, and you're supposed to, you know, when you're on unemployment, and I was making pretty good money, you know, so I got the maximum unemployment, and I was, you know, living in this house with these guys and partying and stuff, and so I don't remember what I was getting, but I was getting like something like, you know, $1,100 a month, which, you know, mid-90s was a decent amount of money for like a 24-year-old, you know, so I was like not really looking for work, you know, and I was, you know, hanging out and lying to the, you know, people at the job place, telling them I'm looking for work and just living off this unemployment. And I'm, you know, I start, you know, selling a little marijuana on the side, you know what I mean? Mostly just to smoke for free and, you know, this kind of stuff. And I'm always like an entrepreneur, you know what I mean? I'm always looking, you know, how can we increase our revenue? I'm really just kind of a bum, really, now at this point, you know? So I'm selling weed and, you know, I'm partying and, you know, on unemployment at the same time and, you know, and this goes on. I think I wrote it out for like a year, you know, just doing nothing. And eventually, you know, the unemployment runs out. Like, if you don't get a job, I mean, they're kind of like, look, man, you know, like, it's been fun, you know what I mean? We're going to have to cut you off. So I started getting a little nervous. So I was hanging out with one of my buddies. And, you know, I'm living in a house, just to paint the picture, I'm living in a house where it's just like a party all the time, you know, other young guys. And, you know, we're throwing parties all the time. You know, there's a lot of drugs there. There's a lot of stuff going on, and I was like one of the few. I was like one of the few purists, like alcoholics. You know what I mean? Like, my roommates judged me in the morning when I would wake up and fix myself like a, you know, a screwdriver or just like, you know. I mean, my favorite thing was just in the first thing in the morning was to go to the freezer and pull out that Absolute bottle. You know what I mean? And just, you know how your warm hands grab that thing, they sort of melt in a little bit, you know what I mean? Pull that thing out, you know, and just pour myself a, you know, stiff drink. I just loved it, man. I loved everything about it. I used to chill my mugs, you know. This is when I was still, you know, this high bottom stuff right here. I would chill my mugs, you know. Fix a cocktail. My roommates who are strung out on like crystal meth are judging me, you know what I mean? They're like, you're drinking in the morning? I was like, look at you, you still have cocaine on your nose. What are you talking about? You know what I mean? You know? And so, you know, the free ride's running out from the government, so I gotta, you know, figure out a plan. And you know, a buddy comes to me and says, hey, you know, I've got this stuff called ecstasy, you know, and this is sort of mid-90s. I was like, you know, I was like, again, what the hell is that? You know what I mean? And he's like, well, you should try it, and then you can sell it for $20 a pill. And I was like, oh. So that caught my attention, you know what I mean? I was like, wow, that's a lot better than these nickel and dime bags I'm selling marijuana to stoners, you know what I mean? I can barely afford that, you know what I mean? And so I, being the gentleman that I am, I was too scared to try it myself, so I gave it to my girlfriend. You know what I mean? let her test it out. Oh, I'm good. I got water. Okay. But I'll take another one. Two is better. You know what I mean? And so I gave it to her. She seemed to like it. You know what I mean? So it was good enough for me. And so I, you know, almost overnight, I was selling ecstasy. You know what I mean? And I, you know, I had never done it personally, you know what I mean, at that point. I was soon to try it. But to me, it was just, you know, I'm just gonna sell this ecstasy and make money, you know what I mean? And I guess, you know, if I lived in Norway or Belgium or something like that, that would probably be not a big deal, you know what I mean? But because I live in Montgomery County, that's a, you know, this is a problem, right? I mean, you know, I'm sure they want people to start and run businesses, but since the pharmacies have a lock on that kind of stuff, and the pharmaceutical companies, you know, this sort of rogue drug dealing is not, you know, it's frowned upon. And so I made a very good living for, you know, a couple of years. And you know, meanwhile, I mean, my life internally is sinking, you know what I mean? I have a lot of fun, you know, I do a lot of things, but internally I'm just dying on the inside. And when you spend every day and every night anesthetized to the degree that you can barely be conscious, you know, a piece of you dies, you know what I mean? I did some fun stuff, but I saw some dark places, you know what I mean? And I saw some things, and saw some things happen to people, and I witnessed some things that would later haunt me, you know, keep me up at night. And I remember this time I was at a party, and I was doing what I do, you know, and, you know, selling some product. Later that night I saw a girl ODing on the floor, foaming at the mouth, turning blue, if anyone's seen it. It's pretty alarming, right? And being the kind of guy I am, like the kind of guy I was with my dad, you know, I literally stepped over like a piece of trash and said, let's get out of here before the cops come. And that kind of like detachment from humanity is inevitable, you know, I would say. And drinking didn't make me that way, you know. Like I said, that spiritual malady was baked in, you know. That's the guy I am. Drinking makes it possible for me to live that way and not feel any regret about it, right? So if you're new, I mean, that's what's really happening, you know. Drinking's the solution, not the problem, you know, for a guy like me at least, you know. And I wish I could stop drinking, you know, and just put the plug in the jug, put it down, and not lose my mind. You know what I mean? But what happens when I do that is I eventually go insane, right? Because all the things I had done up until that moment haunt me, you know? And I see them at night when I go to bed. I relive these things over and over and over again. And so there I am, you know, I'm living like basically like an animal and, you know, just sort of on the fringes of life. And I remember one day I was coming home, like, you know, 6 a.m. on like a Sunday after 2 days of just, you know, partying all night. And I'm coming up Connecticut Avenue. People are coming down Connecticut Avenue. They've got their, you know, families and things like that. You know, they're maybe going down to the mall, take a stroll. And I go into this 7-Eleven in 6 a.m. and I don't even know what I was doing. You know, and I see this family, you know what I mean? They're just like a normal family, you know, doing a Sunday normal thing. And I had such contempt for them, you know. I was like, I feel so bad for those people. You know, look how stupid they are with their stupid life and babies and mortgages and shit. I feel so bad for them, you know. They're missing out. That is the mindset that I was in at that point. Needless to say, that was going to come to an end. And, you know, one day I got a knock on the door and, it was not the pizza delivery guy. It was the DEA. You know what I mean? And that sort of party came to an end fairly quickly. And I was indicted, and I threatened to take it to trial. There was some weird stuff that happened when they broke into the house, and there was a couple loopholes I had, so I threatened to take it to trial. They gave me a plea bargain. And I eventually did about 6 months on that initially, you know. And this is my first attempt to not drink, you know, coming out of that 6 months. Because I had never wanted to quit drinking, you know what I mean? Like, I never even moderated it. I mean, I was living, you know, no one was there to tell me anything. I mean, I just surrounded myself with the same losers, you know? Like it says in our book, you know, the alcoholic life seems the only normal one. I mean, everyone else seemed to be drinking the way I did, you know? So it's not even a thought on my mind. But after this arrest, I was thinking, like, not that I'm alcoholic, right? That's not what I was thinking. I was thinking that if I could not drink, then I probably won't do any drugs, and then I probably won't sell any drugs. That was the calculation I was making in my head, you know what I mean? And so what I thought was a reasonable thing to do when I got out was, you know, just smoke marijuana. I don't know where I came up with that. I mean, looking back, it's not reasonable. I mean, it's like insane. Like anyone looking at my life, like an outsider observer, like almost anyone, I could have picked someone off the street, and they would have been like, look, man, what you're about to do is really stupid, and you're not a very bright person, you know what I mean? And you should probably not do that. But there was no one there to say that to me because I had no one in my life really that would challenge me in that way. You know, family gone, haven't seen them in years, and, you know, they heard about my arrest on the news. That's how they found out. I was on the, you know, 5 o'clock news, Fox 5 investigates. They did a follow-up story on Channel 4, you know, me and all these other hoodlums that were, you know, doing this stuff. And that was how my mom found out, you know. And so I got out and I'm on They put the little ankle thing on, you know, for a little while, and once they cut that thing off, I'm over at my friend's house, of course, because I think, you know, well, I just don't want to drink, make any bad choices, you know what I mean? And I'm smoking weed, and next thing you know, we're at TGI Fridays drinking. Like, how did that happen, you know? And I was like, I didn't normally drink at TGI Fridays, but, I mean, it's been 6 months, so why not? We know the bartender. And then here I am again. I mean, I just got out, and I'm drinking, you know? And then I'm doing all the other stuff I didn't want to do, you know? I'm doing cocaine, I'm doing crystal meth, I'm drinking, you know, I mean, it's just a nightmare. And I'm dodging probation and parole, you know. If anyone's played the 72-hour game, right? Maybe not, okay. So the 72-hour game is that I have to pee in a cup on Tuesday, but it's Saturday night. And I'm going to do cocaine until midnight, and then I'm going to shut it down, right? And so I can, 72 hours, it gets out of your system. This guy knows, so we got one guy. And so I can, you know, maybe I can pass this urinalysis, you know what I mean? But if you think about the logic there, right, no one stops doing cocaine at midnight. I mean, that's like, you know, especially if you're drunk, you know what I mean? Like, it's next to impossible, you know what I mean? So, you know, this is just a massive failure on my part, you know what I mean? Terrible decision making. And, you know, long story short, I ultimately, you know, I spend the next year kind of dodging probation. I'm in this limbo with my friends because no one wants to drink with someone who was federally indicted, you know what I mean? At least not the friends I was hanging. I mean, they were like, look, man. They're like, look, I mean, you were federally indicted, you know. We hope you're having fun, but it's not going to be with us, you know what I mean? And so I'm in this, like, limbo, you know, and I kind of, like, you know, relate to Bill's story where he was like, it's like an unwelcome hanger-oner. That was me. I was an unwelcome hanger-oner. I would call in favors, you know, I'm not working really, and I'm kind of crashing on people's couches now, you know what I mean? And, you know, the party is over. I mean, way over. It's been over. And so I'm slipping into this, like, dark depression, you know what I mean? And I don't really know what to do with my life. And my mom is trying to intervene now, you know what I mean? Which is, like, hell, you know what I mean? I was, like, 26, and my mom's like, you need to do this and see this counselor and this therapist, and, you know, and I'm like, oh, God. But I need her help. So I would go see these people. I have very high regard for outside help. You know what I mean? I think that, you know, I think it's helped my family a lot. You know, my sister with bipolar, my other sister with Asperger's. I think they're very well-meaning. You know what I mean? But I don't think they understand what's wrong with me or understand alcoholism, at least in the way that I needed them to. But I was never honest with them anyway, so it didn't matter. And so I would try this last-ditch effort with medication and therapists, and, you know, it just was like, you know, I wasn't honest with them anyway. So, I mean, they try to, you know, like I said, they try to figure out why I was so messed up, you know, went back to my childhood, and they were doing all this shit, and I was just like, you know, I'm excusing myself and doing cocaine in the bathroom and coming back and seeming very interested, you know what I mean? And, you know, it just didn't do any good, you know, and I borrowed a little money from my mom, and I had gotten violated. So I was due in court in a couple months, and I borrowed a few extra bucks from my mom, and I paid another couple months in rent, you know, where I was staying. And I pretty much just drank myself in and out of consciousness for 2 months. And I bought an ounce of cocaine. I hid it in these. I had a drop ceiling in my basement. I just hid it up there, and then I would get drunk, forget where I hid it, and then I would pull down all the ceiling towels looking for it. You know what I mean? I mean, this is the condition I'm in. You know what I mean? And so I'm drifting in and out of insanity, really, you know, off and on for 2 months. And it was very dark. You know, it was a very dark moment for me. And I felt like at any, you know, there were times where I felt like I could OD, or I had these, like, nightmares of, you know, stairways up to just black doors, you know, very, you know, I mean, You know, when I read about the four horsemen, you know, in our book, it really describes that terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. I mean, really, that was the condition I was in. And, you know, just terrorized by the guilt and the shame and the position in life that I was in now at this point. How did this happen? You know, all of this stuff would run through my head. And the only thing that would take it away was complete oblivion. And so the day would come, I would turn myself in, and that's what I did. I went to court, and I stood up to hear my sentence, and then I blacked out. So I woke up in the little holding cell, and you know, I came to. I was like, you know, didn't know how much time I got. I had up to 5 years I could have gotten, and I just, you know, a lot of people in that position would feel, you know, worried, you know what I mean? Like shit. Like, I'm really locked up. How much time did I get? Blah, blah, blah. And I didn't feel any of that. I felt relieved that I was sort of removed from this, like, hell, you know? And, you know, drinking like that, you know, is sort of like, I mean, it's sort of like this Netherland. It's like, it's almost like purgatory. I mean, purgatory is like hell light. I mean, it's just, it's not bad enough to really get the job done, but it's just like a slow burn every day, you know. It's just that insane, that alcoholic insanity. And so I was relieved that I wasn't, you know, I couldn't get any more alcohol and that I was going to be sort of forced sober. I'd never been to any treatment centers. I'd never been to any rehabs. I had never wanted to stop drinking. So here I am. I'm locked up, and really for me, this is where, you know, my road to sobriety would begin. You know what I mean? And I was there long enough for a couple of years. I was there long enough to physically detox from all the stuff I was on, alcohol, and I spent 3 birthdays back to back, sort of there, you know, while you're locked up. And the thing about being locked up that disturbed me eventually. Didn't disturb me until someone from AA said something to me about it, you know, because they were bringing in AA meetings, and I would sit there and judge them even though they're leaving, you know what I mean? And then one day, I think it was about a year and a half in, and this guy, this old guy named Russ, who was doing H&I forever, he had cataracts in his eyes, he had to be helped in, he was there every Wednesday. One thing he said to me, he said, and it's the way he said it. I mean, because people had said this kind of stuff to me before. You know, he said, "I hope you're used to it here because you're going to be back." You know what I mean? And something about the way he said it, and maybe the fact that I had been, you know, free from alcohol and drugs for a period of time, and maybe I was willing to listen. And I thought about what he said. At first, I was offended, of course, right? Like, whatever, old man, what are you talking about? You know what I mean? At first I was offended, and then I thought about it, and as I was drifting off to sleep, right, with the smell of bleach in my nose and doors slamming and people yelling at each other, as I was drifting off to sleep with all that going on, I realized that I had become used to it, you know. What he said had already happened for me, and that terrified me, you know. So there's a point I think we all get to, you know what I mean, where the price is too high, you know. And I made the calculation, you know, the price was too high. I don't know what's wrong with me, but I need some help. And I don't want to be incarcerated for the rest of my life, you know. And a lot of people say, oh, if you drink, you'll die. I don't know. You know what I mean? Some people do. I don't think that's my fate. I think I would just give away bits and pieces of my life on the installment plan to the courts, you know. That would be my fate. And so I said, you know, I started to listen in the AA meetings. I started to ask questions. You know, he gave me a fit book. You know what I mean? He instructed me to read the doctor's opinion, you know. And the way I looked at it was like, well, this is a doctor, you know. I know he's kind of old. He's probably dead now. You know what I mean? But he's a doctor. He's professional opinion, you know. Because I was weary of AA, you know. I was weary of AA. Not that I judge people in AA. I thought they were quitters. You know what I mean? Like, you quit. Okay? You're out of the club. We don't want to talk to you anymore. You know what I mean? I felt like they were weak, you know, whatever it is. So I read the doctor's opinion, and where it describes, when it talks about being restless, irritable, and discontented, unless we can again experience a sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by a few drinks. When I read that, I had never heard, at least what I thought I had, described in the English language. No one had ever said that to me. A lot of people told me to stop drinking, right? I didn't know they really understood what happens to me when I stop drinking. I'm restless and I'm irritable and I'm discontented. So what it's implying there is that that is my natural condition and that drinking relieves that. And then it made sense to me. And I was sold. I literally was sold. The doctor's opinion sold me on Alcoholics Anonymous. Right there. You know? It's no wonder they put it in front of the book. You know? And there's a lot of other great stuff in there that made sense. You know? We develop a craving. We pass through the well-known stages of a spree. You know, and this is a doctor. He's not an alcoholic. You know? But he could see what was happening. And I related to all of that. You know? And so I became sold almost immediately on Alcoholics Anonymous just by reading that one chapter. And soon I was to get out, and I was to be at the pre-release center where I told you I met my sponsor. And he simply told me his story, you know, one day. He didn't know me at all. He just was there visiting someone else, and he decided to take a few minutes out of his day and talk to me, too, because me and this other guy were going to meetings. And he seemed like he was a guy that was properly armed with the facts. Now, I didn't have that language to describe what he was talking about, but what he seemed like to me was someone that knew the drinking game but was no longer living like that anymore, right? So that's what impressed me. Not that he necessarily knew. Now, well, I mean, he did tell me he tried to snort birth control pills one time to get high. Now, I thought that was stupid, but I was impressed that he tried. You know what I mean? Like, it's not going to work, but you know, I'll give you credit for giving it a shot. I mean, you're a real junkie, you know what I mean? But what impressed me is that he wasn't living that way anymore, and that was the key, right? Now, I'm acutely aware of my current situation, right? Which is, I just did 2 years. I'm basically a ward of the state in this work release program, you know. But how did you make that transition? You know, that's what I was interested in. And so we started on the steps right away. You know, he had me do a fourth and a fifth step before I even got out of that place. And, you know, and like a lot of things in AA, you're not going to, if you're looking to understand why before you do something, forget it. Everything here is backwards, you know. I have to do the work and have the experience, and then I will get it. You know, and fourth and fifth step, I mean, I was so out of it, I didn't even ask why. I was just like, all right, you want me? Okay, I mean, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to write it down. We're going to go over it. And for me, it was not fun. I didn't feel good about it. You know, I wasn't like, whew, God, I feel so much, you know. For me, it was just basically looking at this track record of failure. You know what I mean? It was just like a lifetime of this selfish agenda being implemented at all costs, you know what I mean, and the carnage created from that. That's basically what doing a four step was like for me. And now I felt good knowing that I knew my sponsor better, and I trusted him. And that's, if that's all you take away from that, it's a pretty big deal, you know. Because I think that relationship is sacred, you know, the relationship between a sponsor and the people they sponsor. And so, you know, I met my home group for the first time. I got involved in service, and I made mistakes, you know. I slipped up here and there, you know. I never drank, but I would make mistakes. I would, you know, create new amend-worthy relationships, you know. But overall, I mean, it was rough going at first, but overall my life improved, you know. And I got to learn how to be a real worker among workers, you know. I was fired from my first 3 jobs. I was, you know, I couldn't be a worker. I mean, I was so used to being my own boss. I mean, I hadn't had a job in like 5 years, you know. So I was so used to being my own boss, I just couldn't take criticism or anything or direction or anything. And eventually, you know, some things, you know, took hold, and my life just sort of steadily improved. Not, you know, linear. There were ups, there were downs, but overall, like the stock market, well, it depends on the year you look at it, but it was trending up, you know what I mean? And I was developing a faith, not necessarily in God at first, you know, because I didn't have a relationship with the higher power in that capacity, but I believed in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Because I was free and sober, and that had never happened before. So in my mind, I can only attribute that to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the book talks about, you know, we need to have this psychic change, right? That's also in the doctor's opinion, right? Right after what I just read. And, you know, if we're really going to sort of live at peace in this world, we got to have this psychic change, you know. And so what is that? You know, if you're new, you're like, I don't know what a psychic change is, you know. A psychic change for me really simply is that if I take these steps, right, eventually I will have a new attitude and outlook on life, you know. That's really it. Where I once felt like doom and gloom, I will feel like there's possibly some hope, you know. And I cannot produce a psychic change unto myself, you know what I mean? I can't do anything, you know. I'm powerless, you know. I mean, if I could have changed the trajectory of my life, don't you think I would have before that 2 years spent incarcerated? I mean, I probably would have. I mean, nobody opts into prison. I can just assure you that, you know what I mean? Let me just go away for a little while and see how the other side is living. It's not like that, you know what I mean? So if I could have changed that, I would have. But I couldn't, you know? And I needed to turn my will and my life over to something else. I needed a power greater than myself. And for the first couple of years, that was certainly my sponsor and certainly Alcoholics Anonymous, and still is to a large degree Alcoholics Anonymous. I have an idea of a higher power, but it's nothing like what I grew up with, you know? It's nothing. But you don't have to spend a minute thinking about it. The steps are there for a reason. And when I finally got to my eighth and ninth step, which was about 3 years sober, I was in a lot of debt, you know. And I'll tell a couple quick stories and I'll shut up. I was able to pay off my debt. It took years, I mean years of humble phone conversations with creditors that would just chastise me for not paying my bills for like 10 years, you know what I mean? Eventually I paid it off. You know, I would make amends to my mom and my family. And I eventually, the last amends I made was to my dad. I hadn't been to my dad's gravesite since we buried him. So about 3 years sober, I wrote a letter. I took a guy I was sponsoring, who just celebrated 11 years, not too long ago, and my sponsor, and we went and read the letter to the grave. And I tell you, there weren't any bright lights, burning bushes, nothing like that. But every time I passed that cemetery, I didn't feel that twinge of guilt. Now, it's a little thing, but not really, you know. I mean, that killed me. That guilt, that shame killed me. And that was a huge relief, you know, just that one little bit. Now, there were so many gifts that came from making amends, you know, but that was a huge one, you know. And a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, you had a speaker here named John. And I don't know if he told a story about his mom. And we were good friends, you know, still are. And he was living with me at the time. He was taking care of his mom. And, you know, one night, it was her time, you know. And the person he called was me, you know. And I got to be there for my friend when his mother took her last breath, you know. I got to sort of full circle. I wasn't there for my father, but AA allowed me to be there for him. And if you're new and you're like, man, I just want a job and some money, you know what I mean? And you're thinking, I don't even know what this guy's talking about. Believe me, you want that. You want that. You want those kinds of relationships. And I'm incapable on my own to develop those kinds of relationships. I need Alcoholics Anonymous. And because those are the things that make it worth it, you know. I've got 14 years sober. There's probably people here with double, you know, twice my sobriety, maybe more. But what makes AA relevant for me? A lot of people leave AA. I've seen a lot of people leave AA. you know. They've made the calculation. The calculation they made, whatever they were getting out of Alcoholics Anonymous, isn't worth putting into it, you know. Now, I don't know why, you know what I mean? But to me, there's nothing more worthwhile than helping someone get sober, you know, and taking time out of your day to watch their lives improve. Like I said, I brought that guy when I made amends. He was brand new. He's still sober today, and his life is totally different. Now, so I'm going to make the case for AA, even if you've been sober for a long time. And the case is that you cannot buy that kind of experience anywhere. There's nowhere in life available where you're going to have that kind of impact on somebody. Now, no, that's not necessarily true. Maybe you're part of a church group. You're going to go to Uganda. You're going to build tents. You're going to climb, you know, some mountain somewhere and get a Sherpa to go with you and pray on the mountain. Maybe you're going to do all those things, but I'm not that guy. I'm not going to Uganda, and I'm not building tents. You know what I mean? Let's just be honest. So what I have is right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have the ability to literally be a part of pulling someone back from the gates of insanity and hell and watching their lives transform. Where can you get that? Money's not going to buy that, you know? You can't get that anywhere. And so that's why I'm still here 14 years later. That's why I'm still involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I still go to meetings and sponsor people and take an H&I commitment. That's why I still do all that, because I know that there's nowhere in the world that I can get that kind of feeling except from right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And for me, I'm making the calculation that it's worth it. It's worth it to stay and do the work and dig in your heels and make the sacrifices. It's worth it. It's worth it. Thanks.